Okay. So by now you should have your mystery project, right? Big Excel spreadsheet. Just don't lose sight of the end game, which is finding the five cheapest. This is not an exercise in statistics. It's not an exercise in number crunching. It's an exercise in finding five companies that you think are cheap and five that are expensive. While you're doing that, remember also that these are among the 190 largest market cap companies in the world. You know what that also means, right? You're not going to find an insane bargain. In fact, if you do, something is off with something that you're doing. I'm not saying avoid looking for a bargain, but you're not going to find something to be undervalued by 88%. These are not overlooked companies. Everybody's chasing after them. So keep that in mind as you go through. Use statistics as your tool. Don't become the tool for your statistics package, right? It's not about running R squared. So use statistics when it helps you. Don't use statistics if it doesn't. In fact, if you don't want to use statistics at all, that's fine. I'm willing to accept a completely intuitive reason through choice of five companies. And remember, the second part of your project is to find the one company you're going to target if you're a KKR or a Blackstone or some kind of turnaround specialist. Think of what goes into that choice. So today we're going to. Yes, go ahead.
Can I ask you two quick
Sure.
questions about the project? You say multiple. Does it have to be a number greater than one, or can we use the sort of inverted things like we talked about? Where
what do you mean number greater than? A multiple is any ratio.
Okay, any ratio is fine. And when we use our multiple regression, assuming we do that, can we use other multiples, or can we only use the variable we discuss in the assignment?
Yeah.
Risk, growth, capital.
Use whatever you want.
Okay.
Right? Just be careful that you're not using something that is leading you into an alleyway, right? So there are some choices that will give you things that look good on a statistical basis, no, but might not be what you want in your final choice, right? So let's talk about multiple. Yeah, go ahead, Dipendra.
You said you don't use other data sources. Is that also the case for part B of the question?
Yeah. Don't go outside the data. This is for your own protection. Because otherwise, we're going to be in this war of mutually assured destruction where you're going to go Yahoo, I'm going to go FactSet. FactSet. So let's not even open that door. Stay with what you have. You're saying, I wish I had this, I wish I had that. It doesn't matter what you wish you had. What you have is what you have. Make your best judgment. That's actually what? 160 columns of data? If you can't find what you're looking for with 160 columns of data, you're probably looking for something that doesn't exist. So let it go, right? So let's talk about it. We're going to continue about multiples. Any other questions on the project? Okay. Let's talk about numbers. Don't even try to read what's on this table. This is actually margins for, basically it's from an equity research report that looks at social media companies. And essentially to show you how when you look at an equity research report, you drown in numbers. And these are all the different multiples, 2,000, so basically multiples of 14 earnings, 15 earnings, every conceivable variable that you can think about. So if you get a chance, scan through it, because in a sense, if you had to find a cheap social media company, will you find it in that list? Sure. Relative to other social media companies, you can tell me which ones look cheap or which ones look expensive. If I then asked you, would you buy the stock? It's a different question, right? Because finding the cheapest stock in a sector where everything is priced high just gives you the least overpriced in that sector. So scan through it when you get a chance, because there's some very interesting data that's in here that you might be able to use to make that judgment. But let's actually look at some questions that are pragmatic questions. Let's say you can do relative valuation. You can use price earnings ratios, book value multiples, revenue multiples, all kinds of multiples. Assume you're trying to do a relative valuation of a company. And let's give the company a name, Zyloft. It's a software company, and you're trying to decide which multiple to use in your valuation. This is something you're going to face on your big project. So I'm going to give you the choices. The first is you can pick the multiple that yields the highest R squared for the, you know what I mean by highest R squared? You have 35 companies, you try PE, price to book, there's one that yields. Second is, rather than pick one, you might just pick a bunch of different multiples and compute an average across the multiples. The third is you can go with the multiple that most other people in the sector focus on. So if you're looking at a cable company, everybody looks at EBITDA multiples. If you're looking at technology companies, everybody might look at, revenue multiples. You can pick the multiple that best fits what you're trying to do with the valuation. You see, but in the project, what are you trying to do? You're trying to finish a report and turn it into me so that you get a grade, right? Let's be completely pragmatic. So you want to find a multiple that makes that job easier rather than more difficult, right? So here's where you are. You've done a discounted cash flow valuation, which has already given you a number for your company. What's the most convenient thing to find on your relative valuation? What makes writing the report so much easier? Is if you get a value that actually is very close to your discounted cash flow. Look, so I'm not saying it's a very cynical view of multiples, but you're going to try 7 and say, that multiple will make my job a lot easier when I write the report. File that away, because if you're even remotely tempted to do that, think of how analysts pick multiples when they're trying to sell you something. It's not based on what's the best multiple, it's what makes my storytelling easiest. Okay? So I'm not even going to give you the right answer here, because in a sense we're going to talk about this today. But you can already see that having all these different multiples in front of you is a mixed blessing. You still have only one decision you can make. You can buy or you can sell. Okay, so whether you use 17 multiples or one multiple, that decision is not going to change. So you can be a pure engineer, a quant person, and say, I'm going to go with the highest R squared. I'm not sure that is necessarily the best solution if you're trying to make an investment decision. You can go with what everybody else is using. Not necessarily, again, the best decision. So there is no one dominant rule. So it's a choice that you will face sooner or later, and you got to think about how you're going to make that choice. Finally, I actually have one more. Let's say you do an intrinsic valuation of a company. And this, again, is not in the abstract because you're going to face this problem. Let's suppose you arrive at a value of $10 per share and the stock is trading at 15. So the intrinsic valuation says the stock is overvalued, right? Now, let's say you value the same stock using a P/E ratio against other software companies, and you come up with $20 per share based on a multiple. Remember what I said, you have only one decision you can make. You can either buy or sell. The price is 15. It's right in the middle. So I'm going to ask you to just tell me what you're going to do with these numbers. So first is, you can say the stock is undervalued. So you can really make a conclusion. You say stock is undervalued because, you know, you've done a relative valuation and gave you a higher number. You can say it's overvalued. You can say it's actually correctly valued. See how you come up with the correctly valued? You take the 10 and the 20, you add them up and divide by 2. You can tell me it's both under and overvalued, which is an excellent position to be in, because you can take both sides of the table, right? Or maybe it's none of the above. Again, there's no answer that I can say is the right answer. It depends on what? Remember at the start of the class I said, are you playing the pricing game? Are you playing the valuation game? If you're playing the pricing game, what should you go with?
That it's undervalued.
Go with undervalued. You think it makes, you know, pricing game, that's all you care about, is you go with the price. That's why we do pricing. If you play the valuation game, then you won't buy the stock. It's overvalued. You know the one game you shouldn't be playing? Is acting like you're both a pricer. The one thing you should never do, and it's done all the time, is add up a relative valuation to an intrinsic value and claim that the true value is in between. Now, I see these in IPO valuations. You'll see a DCF value, 4 multiples, all added up and divided. This is like saying, I'm going to be a Muslim in the morning and a Buddhist in the afternoon. Somewhere along the way, you're going to face some choices which are not going to be palatable on one side or the other. You can't be both a pricer and a valuer. So make up your mind. I don't care if you go with the 20 and say, I'm a trader, that's fine. I don't care if you go with the 10 and say, I'm an investor, I won't buy the stock. But don't try to straddle those two, because philosophically, they're very different ways of thinking about investing. Finally, let's assume we're going to today talk about market regressions, where we price a stock against the entire market, not just against a sector. Do you see the distinction? So rather than price Google against other social media technology companies, I price Google against the rest of the market. Let's say based on that pricing, I arrive at $10 per share. Very different again from the 20 I got from looking at the sector. So now let me ask you a question again. How do you reconcile? They're both pricing, right? One is priced against the market, the other is priced against the sector. If I asked you to intuitively explain what those two numbers mean, how would you reconcile the fact that you're getting a pricing of 10 and a price. This is no longer intrinsic value versus price. It's pricing versus pricing. How would you explain the difference? Joseph, you want to try?
Yeah, it seems like the software, you could say maybe the software industry is overpriced relative to the market.
In other words, when I price something relative to just social media companies, I'm making a judgment, right? I'm saying relative to these stocks, this stock is undervalued. But relative to a very different group of stocks, so if you're a golfer, you hang out in your club, you might be the very best golfer in your club because you're surrounded by duffers. But if you're a golfer and you showed up at Augusta yesterday and you were surrounded by those guys, and I ask you, are you a good golfer? You're saying, relative to what? Relative to those pros, you're nothing. So that's the same thing. Depending on who you compare a stock to or what group you compare a stock to, you can come up with different judgments. And guess what? You're going to have to deal with that as well on your stock. Because I'm going to give you a simple way in which you're going to be able to price your company relative to the market. So I'm preparing you for the fact that as we go through this process, you have an actual price, you're going to have an intrinsic value, a price relative to the sector, a price relative to the market, and even the price relative to the sector, you can get a price against just US stocks, global stocks, just social media companies, all technology companies. And you're going to see as you expand and contract that your conclusions will change. So all things to file away, because somewhere during the course of today, we will talk about all of those. So let's close that up. So last session, I was talking about looking at telecom ADRs and how to make a judgment about whether a stock is under or overvalued. Now, use the Telebras example, where after you control for growth and risk, before you controlled it, it looked for cheap, right? Trading at 8.9 times earnings. But after you control for differences in growth and risk, it looked overvalued. So today, I'm going to continue this game. I'm going to start off being the equity research analyst that tracks European banks. So I'm going to give you some statistics on these banks. So this is from 2010. They're the price-to-book ratios. So low price-to-book is good, right? Then I give you the return equity. Low return equity is bad. And I throw in a standard deviation method. We'll talk about whether that's the best measure of risk or whether there's a better measure of risk for banks. Okay? So you look at the data. So you've got three columns of data: how it's priced, what kind of return it makes, how risky it is. Even eyeballing the data, you can already see that most of the stocks that are bunched up at the top are there for a reason, right? Like, no, I can't even pronounce that. Berishi Hapound over in Spain is trading at 80% of book value, but its return on equity is minus 1.66%. And the same thing, so as you look at the top four companies, they all have abysmal returns on equity. If you look at the bottom of the list, most of the companies with high price to book ratios end up with high returns on equity. And that's going to be true in almost every sector that's mature, is the low price to book companies have low returns on equity. So you're looking for mismatches, right? So I'm going to give you a simplistic way of finding those mismatches. We don't have to draw on statistics. Compute the median values for each of the three data points. So you've got a median price to book ratio of 2.07, a median return on equity of 11.82%, and a median standard deviation of 22%. So what are you looking for? You want a company with low price to book, high return on equity, and low risk, right? So here's a simplistic device. Look for stocks that trade at below 2.07 in terms of price to book. So that's quite a few, right? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Okay, you've got 9 stocks. Then among the 9 stocks, look for stocks which have returns on equity that exceed 11.82%. Oh, there's one. So 9 became... one. So there's one stock that has a price-to-book ratio less than the median return equity. Then look for stocks which have standard deviations less than or more than the median. You want less. Well, there goes your one stock. See, this was pointless. Hey, no harm looking, right? You never know what you'll find. In this case, there's nothing that looks obviously mismatched. Doesn't mean you won't buy any of these, but there's no obvious stand-up. You can also go the other direction. Look for stocks that are overvalued, because let's assume you can sell short. You want stocks that have price-to-book ratios greater than 2.07, so that's the bottom half. Okay? You want a return on equity less than 11.82%. Nothing there. So you've lost the entire group because I think they all have returns in equity. Oh, no, I'm sorry. Erste Bank. That's an East European bank. So high price to book. And you want a standard deviation that is higher than the median. So if there's one stock that looks interesting, it's at Erste Bank. I'm not sure you want to jump in and do anything radical with this, but shows you when you look at large samples. That's one way to go about it, is think in terms of the medians and compare yourself. Don't try this with 190 companies. So this shouldn't be your tactic of choice because there's too many. But if you have small samples, it's a very simplistic device for finding mismatches. Is compute the median and look for companies that meet your requirements for a mismatch. So any questions on that? So that's, as I said, though, as the sample size gets bigger, this gets more and more difficult to do. Yeah, go ahead, John. Well, the reason for that is just that you have too much stuff to think about, right? I mean, it's 220 companies. You have no idea what other stuff you might want to control for. Right? Because as your sample size gets bigger, you're obviously also bringing in smaller banks, riskier banks, other stuff that you want to control for. Incidentally, I don't like the standard deviation measure for risk because it's a stock price measure. When we think about risky banks in today's world, what do we tend to think about as risky? What makes some banks riskier than others? Is there something I can, you know, that I can focus on that's not price-based? Or
capital reserves?
One is you can look at the tier one. I mean, to me, the big thing you worry about with banks is, am I buying a bank which is undercapitalized or overcapitalized? So instead of using the standard deviation, I could use the tier one capital ratio, which you can pull off capital IQ. And there, a higher number is safe and a lower number is risky, of course, you know, we're assuming a lot of different things. But that's the thing to remember about relative valuation. You're no longer constrained by how we think about numbers as we are. In discounted cash flow valuation, you can't make up risk measures as you go along. I'd stop you and say, no, you can't do that. That's diversifiable risk. You can't. But when you're doing relative valuation, if you want to come up with a creative way of measuring risk in a particular sector, go for it. Okay? It's pricing. And when you're doing pricing, the rules are a lot looser. In fact, here's what I did with this sector. And this approach will scale up, whether you're 10 or 15. I took the sample of 18 banks. It's a small sample. The two things I'm worried about are return on equity and risk. I threw those into a regression. So it's price to book against return on equity and standard deviation. Let's do some stat 101. Numbers in brackets below are the T statistics, right? Basically, you can use whatever other statistic measure. T statistic greater than 2 meets your statistical significance, so the relationships are statistically significant. Every 1% increase in ROE increases my price-to-book ratio by 0.0363, and every 1% increase in standard deviation lowers my price-to-book. So at least the signs are in the right direction. The overall R-squared is 79%, but with a sample size of 18. That's a little misleading, because all you need are two outliers in the that kind of fit the data, and your R-squareds can pop up. So basically, but with that 18 days, I can use this regression then to get predicted price-to-book ratios. So think of this as a more general, rather than eyeballing the data, where you use the data to come up with predicted price-to-book, you compare the actual to the predicted to come up with a percentage under or over valuation. And you can rank them based on how under or over valued you are. Any questions? So with a small sample, you can eyeball the data, you can use the median approach, but even with a small sample, sometimes running regressions allows you to do more creative things with the data than just eyeballing it.
Those yes. Factors you're using, are the correlation coefficients?
Not the correlation coefficients, those are actually the coefficients on the variables. When you run a multiple regression, that's the output that shows up under the coefficients, and the T statistics will show up in the next. If you're using Minitab, usually those pieces of output come out. Incidentally, we have a PC version of Excel. The analysis tool pack allows you to do multiple regressions. Excel is just really hard to work with for statistics because your independent variables have to be in contiguous columns. It's a pain in the neck. So if you can use a statistics package, it's probably easier because it gives you more leeway to run things then. No, but even within Excel, you can run many of these regressions. Any questions? Now, here's the interesting thing, and I mentioned this last week. I've been tracking the price-to-book ratios for U.S. banks now for a long time, right? And if you look pre-2008, U.S. banks used to trade at 2 times book value, 2.5, 3, 4. In fact, they got as high as in 2004. They were trading at close to 6 times book value. You're saying, so what? Remember that intrinsic price-to-book equation? That if people expect you to make more than your cost of equity, you will trade at above book value. So clearly, if you go pre-2008, for better or worse, even though there were variations across time, investors collectively expected banks to generate a return equity higher than the cost of equity. And banks seem to be delivering. Then you get to 2008. And clearly, the game's changed since. In fact, since 2008, now 2009, price to book dropped below 1. You could say it's a crisis, right? There's a big thing hanging over the banks. Therefore, and in fact, it recovered back in 2010. Everybody heaved a sigh of relief, saying we're back to pre-crisis times. But here's the interesting thing. In 2011 and 2012, and this is actually continuing through now, the price-to-book ratios for banks have dropped again below 1, even though their returns in equity are climbing. So you can read this in one of two ways. You can decide that investors are being completely irrational in the pricing of banks and jump in big time into JP Morgan, Citi, add them all to your portfolio, saying, given the return equity, you should be trading at 1.5 to 2.5 times book value. Or what else could explain why the price-to-book ratios have dropped below 1? I mean, if the returns on equity are improving, shouldn't the price-to-book also go up above 1? What are the other potential explanations? Yeah. One is maybe the investors are saying, but the cost of equity has to have climbed to what, 14, 15%, and to get there, your beta, especially in today's market, has to be 2. Maybe that is possible, but that seems like a big jump in the cost of equity. So that could be a partial explanation. But I don't think, I mean, cost of equity might have gone from 7 to 9, but I don't think it's gone from 7 to 15. What's the other? These are actual returns on equity, which I compute by taking net income and dividing by book value of equity, right? As an investor, what are you worried about? What have we been hit the last 6 years? Every time you think it's over, a bank says, you know what, we're taking off another $10 billion, another $5 billion, another $15 billion. I think with banks, this has become that shoe that's waiting to drop that investors have almost built into prices. They're saying, nice income, but I know something's coming. So it's actually not just an abstraction. It's a very interesting choice we face as investors as to whether markets are right when they say, don't trust these banks on net income, or whether the bankers are right when they say the bad stuff is all behind us. Okay? Because the market clearly doesn't believe the bankers, and whether you do or not will then determine whether you're 30% in banks or 10%, because some of the cheapest companies out there right now are financial service companies. Big financial service companies look cheap, but the question is, do you want to jump in? Any questions? Yes, Nick. I did all banks. So I actually started with all banks, and I did money center banks, and I did the 20 largest banks. In fact, it gets worse and worse and worse as you go from all banks to large. It used to be the reverse, right? As you went from all banks to large banks, the price-to-book ratios would go up. As you went from large banks to money center banks, it would go up even more. Now it's actually the reverse. In fact, the degree of distrust is greatest at the large banks. Okay? Which might explain why GE finally decided to get out of the banking business. That's big, right? Do you see why what the connection is? If you're GE, you're double affected now. Not only is your GE capital being priced less than it should be, but there's this contamination effect, which is if you're hiding something at GE capital, I'm going to knock down the value that I attach to GE aircraft. So when we do some of the parts valuation, you're going to see this start to play out. Is there's a very interesting thing going on in markets that might be worth watching over time because it might be an investment opportunity in either side, depending on what your view is about the future. Yes, ma'am. Joe.
So in this case, you say that the market collectively believes that the bankers...
At least it's pricing them as if the return equity is not what it's stated
right.
to be.
So even if you do like agree with the bankers that the net income is the net income, doesn't it kind of not matter?
No, because remember, you can collect the cash flows, right? Pay the low price. If the earnings are going to stay up, you know how it's going to show up? You're going to get 7% dividend yields on banks.
Okay.
For as far as the eye can see.
Okay.
Well, eventually, at some point in time, if there is no shoe waiting to drop, the market will wake up. It's not like it's going to be an eternity. You might have to wait 2 years or 3 years or 3.5 years with nothing happening before that. No. So if you truly believe that the worst stuff is behind you for banks, I think, you know, it's collectively, banks are a good place to put your money. But that becomes a big question. Maybe there's a way to screen the banks into trustworthy banks and non-trustworthy banks. Pricing, you can do whatever you want. Maybe the trustworthy banks are the banks which have never reported a big write-off in the last 5 years. Because there is this contamination effect where banks that haven't done anything are being hurt by banks that have done a lot of bad stuff and have hidden it. So maybe there's a way to kind of splice the data to come up with the banks that you want to put your money in. Yes? Well, even before they did this, what we talked about in the context of complexity, I think I've been arguing that GE should not have had GE. I think having a financial service firm within a company is a bad idea for any company. And we've talked about why. You put in a bank in the middle of a company, it makes everything messier. And whatever justifications are offered for it, none of them hold up to scrutiny. Most financial service firms are captive banks. You know what I mean by captive banks, which is, their financing is only for the products that, so Boeing Capital does only the financing for Boeing planes. GMAC does financing only if you buy a Chevy or a GM car. So their argument is we need these financing companies to do what? To offer below market rates. Because let's face it, if it were market rates, you don't need below market rates to our customers so they'd buy our product. To which my point is, what have you gained by doing that? You've sold more stuff than you normally would have, but you've subsidized this with another part of your company, and now I'm now looking at the collective company saying, what the heck happened here? Because none of these, I mean, these GE capitalities can live on its own. GMAC, you try to hive it off and sell it, who the heck wants to buy a captive financing company where they're at the mercy of the parent company? So GE Capital at least had that option. Many of the other captive financing arms don't. And I've always thought it's a bad idea to have it. And post-2008, that argument applies in spades. Okay. Yes?
Do you feel the same way about captive insurance companies?
Captive insurance companies, there might be... I have the same argument. If you have a captive insurance company, you've got to tell me what you gain by having that captive insurance company. Do they have access to information that an independent insurance company... Maybe that's what it is. Maybe because you can give them proprietary data that they can use to assess your risk. So it's got to be some very specific kind of risk that you cannot convey to the rest of the world that you can convey to a captive insurance company. Or it might be some tax benefit that you're getting that you're not even mentioning to me. But I want you to be open about what you're doing underneath that creates a value, because there's nothing, again, that makes a captive insurance company a value adder by itself. Right? Start of every year, I do this exercise. It takes about 5 minutes. It's a fun exercise. You can try this if you get a chance. I go to Capital IQ. I pull up the 100 largest market cap companies. Very simplistic. I pull up the price-to-book ratios. Basically, let me take that back. I pull up the market cap, I pull up the book value of equity, and I pull up the net income. I mean, a Capital IQ actually offers a price-to-book. I just don't trust anybody else's computation, not because they don't do it right, but because I have no idea what they do. Then I divide the market cap by the book value to come up with the price-to-book ratio for every company, and I divide the net income by the book value to come up with the return equity for every company. So that takes all of, 5 minutes to do? And then I plot it in a scatter plot. Remember scatter plots from statistics? You have price to book on one axis, return equity on the other. So there's the price to book, return equity. And each of these is a company. I haven't labeled all of them because initially I did, but it looked like this gigantic thing. It exploded on my page. So I've kind of highlighted a few companies. You're saying, what are these? The middle line is, do you know what that middle line is? That's my best fit line. It's a regression line of price to book against return equity. There's the R-squared up there, 59%, which is pretty good for one variable. What are these two outside lines, you think? They're actually the standard error lines. In fact, in most statistics packages, you can ask it to draw the outside line. You're saying, why are you doing that? Anything that falls between those two lines, I cannot statistically reject the argument that they're fairly priced. So what I'm looking for are the points outside of those lines. So let me list out the three companies above and the three companies below the lines. First, which are my overvalued companies? Above the line or below the line? Above the line. So there are my overvalued companies, Google, Infosys, and Gilead Systems. So file that away. Because what you're looking for is there a pattern here? Is there something I'm missing? Because it could be that these are overvalued stocks, or there's something else I'm not capturing for. With those three companies, what do you think the missing variables? Why do you think those companies look expensive but might not be? I'm looking at price to book and return equity, but I'm not controlling for high growth, right? Which is, if I have a high growth company with the same price to book return equity, is there a way I could bring growth into this process? Have you ever seen three-dimensional scatter plots? They're kind of dizzying to look at. It's like looking at a cardboard box. Here's a three-dimensional scatter plot. So you got price to book, return equity, growth on the other axis. Tell me where in that box your cheap stocks are. Which corner should I be? No. I want low price to book, right? I want high return equity. So low price to book, high return equity. Low growth or high growth? High growth. So I'm looking in this corner. There's nothing there. But again, remember, these are the 100 largest market cap companies. You're not going to find something way in the corner, so you can keep moving up. In fact, the closest I get to a cheap stock is Time Warner. So looking above the line, I'm not really going to sell short on Gilead Systems and Infosys because I know growth is the missing variable. Let me go below the line and list the three companies that came out as cheap in 2010. COP is ConocoPhillips, Nokia, and ExxonMobil. Already red flags should be going off. Two of the three are oil companies, not just commodity companies, but oil companies. You're saying, so what? Right now, when you draw this graph in this market, don't be surprised to see a lot of oil companies show up as cheap, because what am I doing? I'm taking market cap that reflects where we are today in the oil market, book value equity that reflects absolutely nothing because the accountant is too lazy to update everything, and net income from when? The last 12 months. Do you see where this is going to lead you? For six of those 12 months, oil prices were $85 a barrel. The market doesn't reflect that anymore. So if you look below the line, you're saying, you know what? Those stocks look cheap, but maybe I'm not controlling for the fact. What I'm saying is, when you get those five cheapest stocks out of the 190, if four of the five are from the same sector, be very cautious about jumping in and saying, those are my cheap stocks. Because what they might reflect is something you're missing that is making them look cheap right now. In fact, not only am I not controlling for differences in growth, I'm also not controlling for differences in risk, right? So I tried one more, since I was so fond of these boxes. I decided I can't do a four-dimensional graph. That I tried that. It actually shows up as eight boxes, and I was just too dizzying for me. So I took price to book, return equity, beta. Where in this box are my cheap stocks? Maybe I should put this on the next quiz. Give you a box and say, find the corner where you find. So I want low price to book, I want high return equity, and I want low beta or high beta? Low beta. So that's about as close. That's the corner. Again, nothing obviously in that corner, but that's the nature of the process. You think, this is a waste of time. There's nothing in the corner. That's because I looked at the 100 largest market cap stocks, right? Go to Capital IQ and pull up 100 mid-cap or 100 small-cap stocks. Hey, who knows? You could get two or three stocks that end up being overlooked and somehow end up in the corner. Again, you're not going to jump in and buy those stocks right away, but if you're looking at where should I spend my time on my next intrinsic valuation, this is taking a long time to value a company. I can't just start with A and work through Z. This is one way to kind of narrow your focus and say those are the companies where the payoff is greatest. So again, I mean, it's a combination of visually displaying the information and looking at statistics. And in fact, if I ran a regression with just these 100 companies, I get an R squared of almost 67%. Okay? And you can see that the beta doesn't seem to show up as statistically significant, and that doesn't surprise me. You look at the 100 largest market cap companies, you're not going to get really risky and really safe companies. These companies are very big companies already. But high return on equity translates into much higher price-to-book ratios. No surprise there. And higher growth rate translates into a much higher price-to-book again. So again, we're using statistics, not so much because we want to break things down, but because we want to use this as a mechanism for deciding which are the cheap and which ones are the expensive stores. Okay. Any questions? So this is actually something you can do in 15 minutes. If you have access to Capital IQ, just go in and screen for the largest market cap companies. All you need are three variables on each company: market cap, net income, book equity. While you're there, might as well pull up the beta and the growth rate in case you want to control for those differences. And it's amazing how much you can explain with just that basic data. Okay. Incidentally, there is a fairly widely read book by Joel Greenblatt. You read this book? The Little Book of Investing? You know what his strategy for finding undervalued stocks is, right? What's the combination looks for? High return on equity and low, what's the multiple uses? Low EV to EBITDA. So basically, actually, he has a mismatch already up there. You see what the mismatch is? If you're looking at low EV to EBITDA rather than return equity, what should you be focusing on? It is return on invested capital. And so basically, you look for low EV to EBITDA, high return on invested capital. And you can already see that basically with any multiple, you can create your own Greenblatt equation. It's just mismatches you're looking for. And in fact, if you want to make it your own, you can add a third variable. You can have low EV to EBITDA, high return on capital, low risk, and use your own proxy for risk. And there you are, off to the races. Give it a title, call it, give it your name. So-and-so's the proprietary screening approach, put a little R in a little circle next to it. Charge people for the advice. So I'll show you what the January 2015 data looks like. Again, don't do anything rash. So this is what the market looks like right now. Okay. So above the line, so this is, as of update, price to book versus return equity. Above my line are my overvalued. Let's go through the list, and you tell me whether you think they're overvalued, whether I'm at, you got Amazon. No surprise there. You got two pharmaceutical companies, or biotechnology companies, Regeneron and Celgene. And you got Clorox way up there. You say, what do you mean? 45 times book value. That's what it trades at. You know why it trades at 45 times book value? Because they've almost written off their entire book equity through buybacks. And the way it shows up is your return equity is 150%. If you really think Clorox is making 150% return on its new projects, you're dreaming, but it captures it, right? That's the advantage of bringing both sides of the equation. You just look at the price to book. It looks horrible. If you look at just the return equity, it looks amazing. You look at the two together, you're saying, I'm not that impressed. Right? Now, so that's it. You got Philip Morris up there too. Really high price to book, really high return equity. Again, the buyback effect is kicking in. Let's go below the line. And there's only one stock that actually shows up as below the line. The others all are on the line. And that is IBM. For better or worse, based on the numbers, IBM looks like a mismatch. The price to book it trades at doesn't reflect its return equity. Again, I'm not saying don't go out and buy IBM. I'm saying maybe your next DCF valuation, as you already have one for the project, do a second one. Should be IBM. There's something there that doesn't match up. And perhaps digging a little deeper will tell us what's going on. So those are with big samples, 100 largest market cap companies. Let's return to sector research. So I got fired again. I'm repeatedly fired, sector after sector. I'm now the trucking analyst. And this is my sector. You can't even read the companies. But I'll pick one company. I'm going to put a buy recommendation on Ryder Systems. You know why I like it? It's trading at 2.8 times EBITDA. We talk about rules of thumb. This clearly blasts through any rule of thumb, right? 2.8 must mean it's cheap. In fact, the sector trades at 5.6 times EBITDA. And this stock trades at half that multiple. So one possible explanation is it's really cheap. People are messing it up. But I'm going to let you ask me questions. Remember, I said part of relative valuation is knowing what questions to ask. So I'm going to play the role of your broker, the guy you've been trying to get rid of because you have an online account, but I keep calling you. I call you and say, do I have a stock for you? Ryder Systems, trading at 2.8 times EBITDA. So ask me some questions. Remember the variables that drive EV to EBITDA. So go item by item. What's my tax rate? You're looking for a 90% tax rate. Not there. So knocked it off. That looks pretty good. What else? What's my cost of capital? Well, it's like any other trucking company, nothing unique, so my cost of capital is pretty much like everybody. It's starting to look interesting. They ask me, what's my reinvestment rate? I tell you that I had no reinvestment last year. None. You're saying, this is really good news. Is it? Jordan? The debt ratio for Ida when I did this was not bad. It's embedded in the cost of capital. So basically, if they were over-levered in the verge of distress, that would explain it. Didn't look bad. Actually, we're growing pretty much the same rate as everybody else, but I had no reinvestment last year. And therein lies something to think about. One of the things about trucking companies is they replace their entire fleets rather than do it partially every year, because you get a much better deal as a discount. So you actually go, no reinvestment, no reinvestment, no big reinvestment, no reinvestment, no reinvestment, no reinvestment, big reinvestment. So the fact that I told you there was no reinvestment, the next question is, how old is my fleet? I would say about 4.95 years. So ask me the next question. How often do I replace my fleet? 5 years, every five. So here's what's going to happen. You're going to buy this stock today. About 2 weeks from now, you're going to open up the paper, and what are you going to read? Ryder System announces huge capital infusion to buy its entire fleet. There goes your cheap stock. The reason I picked this is I actually pulled this off an actual equity research report. There's a buy recommendation because of the low EV to EBITDA and all the other metrics. All I had to do was 15 minutes of research to pull up the age of the fleet for each of the trucking companies for me to at least ask that follow-up question. How do I factor in that my entire fleet is going to get replaced in a few weeks, and that'll make this cheap stock look expensive? What I'm saying is, if you use multiples, at least dot your I's and cross your T's, right? So look at the variables, ask the question about tax rates and return on capital and reinvestment before you tell me to buy something. Because if I have to uncover that with 15 minutes of research, then you clearly haven't finished your research when you say buy the stock based on a multiple. So walk into any investment bank, pick up a bunch of equity research reports. You can very quickly start classifying analysts into good analysts who do their homework, check cross. And those who are just incredibly sloppy, who make their judgments based on surface-level multiples and say, this is cheap, this is expensive, and never bother to ask the follow-up questions. Now comes one of my favorite examples. You're familiar with Whole Foods, right? Until Whole Foods came along, you never wanted to be the grocery store analyst. Every company was incredibly boring. They had these tiny margins, huge sales to capital ratios, traded a bit at these low, because what, there's no growth, there's no, I mean, it's boring business. So when Whole Foods came along, of course, the grocery store analysts had no idea what to do with this company because it was like unlike any other grocery store company out there. But the one thing they did notice was it had much higher margins than everybody else, and anybody who's walked into a Whole Foods knows why. I made the mistake of walking into that prepared food section yesterday because I had to go to the Home Depot next door and I was hungry. You might as well go to a five-star restaurant because they do it by weight. So I tried to go with the light food, which is, you know, when I picked it up. I walk out of there $20 later, you know. I said, what the heck did I just do? Okay. But the high margins reflect that they charge high prices and it shows up as high margins. So initially when they showed up, they had high margins. They used to trade at these huge multiples of revenues. And the justification that analysts gave, at least in the face of it, was, hey, they deserve to trade at a high multiple of revenues relative to the other grocery stores because they have higher margins. That part of the statement is right, right? The question is, how much higher? So here's what I did. Starting January 2007, I've done this every year because it's almost like watching a lab experiment play out. I took the price to sales. I could have done EV to sales. You get pretty much the same thing. And net margin. And I graphed it out. So there's all of the grocery store companies within the lines. And then there is Whole Foods. So I ask you, who's the outlier? Nobody's saying, oh, my God, I don't see an outlier there. It's just sticking up, right? In fact, I ran a regression of price to sales against net margin. And clearly, higher margin companies have higher price to sales ratios. But my predicted price to sales ratio for Whole Foods, in spite of its higher margin, was 0.43. It was trading at 1.41 times revenues. So I couldn't understand it. I said, I must be missing something. Maybe there's a non-linear relationship that's in there that's kicking up that doesn't explain it. So I said, let's wait a year and see what happens. This is 1 year later. This is, I'm sorry, 2 years later, January 2009. I take the grocery store sector. I plot it out. And I said, where the heck is Whole Foods? It was right, it was way up there. You know where it is? It's at the, it went from being the most overvalued stock in the sector to the most undervalued. There it is at the very, it's not quite below the line, but it's very close to the line. It went from having, so it's price to sales went from 1 point something down to 0.31, but its predicted price to sales was 0.36. So an overvalued, undervalued. Then I looked again in 2010. Okay. See where Whole Foods is now? I can't even see it. Where the heck is it? It seems to have disappeared off the sample somewhere. It should be somewhere. It's back to being above the line, see? So it went overvalued, undervalued, back to being overvalued. Now there's one something even more overvalued, so maybe you can point to it and say, relative to that, it looks undervalued, but no, that's up to you. Okay. 2011. Finally, it's found its steady state. It's right on the line now. Overvalued, undervalued, overvalued, on the line. You're saying, this is it. Well, it's 2015. I shouldn't draw the second line. Whole Foods is slightly over, it's back to being overvalued, but now there's a new star in town. A company called Sprouts. Have you heard about this? This is the young natural grocery store. It's more West Coast based than East Coast based. People have all of a sudden stopped caring about Whole Foods and they've moved on to the next big shooting star go through. So starting this year, guess what I'm going to do? I'm going to track Sprouts. Okay? Because this is not unusual. This is exactly what happens when you throw a company that doesn't look like the rest into a group. The market doesn't get it right. It overshoots, it undershoots. Because what the investors are doing is they're essentially reacting to the most recent information they get. And since they have no metric that works, you're going to get this mechanism, and that's good for you and I as investors. Okay? I've actually bought Whole Foods twice and sold Whole Foods twice in the last 4 years. But it's actually a stock that's worth playing as an investor, even though it's shooting all over the place, because it's the changing that's causing your value. Buying it when it's cheap and you're selling it back when it's expensive. Buying it when it's cheap and selling it back when it's expensive. And Sprouts maybe. So I'm ready to move on because Whole Foods is starting to get a little boring right now. Might as well move to the next most exciting thing and see if market mistakes are magnified. It's go where it's darkest. Where markets least understand a company is where you're going to find the biggest mistakes. Now, for some of you, when you get to this stage in your project, and you pick a multiple, and you pick the comp, every example that I've given, at least the numbers fit, right? High price to book, high return equity. High price to sales, high margins. But let's say you pick a sector. You do a scatter plot, look at the scatter plot, and say, what the heck am I going to do with this? And I'll take you back. Remember that 2000 valuation I did of Amazon where I found it to be significantly overvalued? It was like four sessions ago. Stock was at 84. It was trading at, and I valued it at 34. I decided to do a relative valuation of Amazon in early 2000. Relative to what? Relative to other dot-com companies. I picked a revenue multiple. You know why, right? Because if I picked an earnings multiple, there were two out of the 100 that actually showed up. So basically, I had to keep rising up the income statement until I had a number that I could use. Revenue multiples, and we know the companion variable for revenue multiples is margins. So I took revenues multiples versus margins, plotted them out. This is what the scatter plot looked like. What's my job? To get a best fit line through this. Good luck with this. It's like a shotgun blast. All it's all over the place. Undaunted, I decided to run a regression. You know what I'm going to find in the regression, right? My R squared is going to be tiny. But I'm going to fit the line anyway. And here's what I found. Based on how dot-com stocks were being priced in early 2000, the intercept is high. It's 81. 81 times revenue is your starting point. And every 1% increase in margins, and this is a scary coefficient, does what to your multiple? Lowers your multiple. So the more money you lose, the higher. So some companies took this to heart. Remember in the early part of that last decade, they say, you lost $2 billion, we can lose three. You lost three, we can get to five. So it's almost like, so maybe they were reading this regression and saying, we should lose more money because that's a good sign. In fact, if I were writing a book on irrational exuberance, this could be exhibit one, right? Look how crazy people are. The more money you lose, the higher your revenue multiple. But that wouldn't be quite fair. Even at its craziest, markets have have their own internal logic. So here are the two ways you can get around this problem, because some of you are going to face this problem. I know some of you, and at least one person is valuing Twitter, you know, at least one is valuing all the social media companies. When you do this, you take social media companies and you try to fit a multiple to whatever the companion variable is, you're going to see something that looks like those dot-com companies. So I'm going to suggest two ways you can get around this. Here's the first. Put yourself in the shoes of investors who are pricing dot-com stocks in early 2000. They're not pricing it based on how much money these stocks made in the past. They're pricing it on expectations of the future. You think they're unrealistic? Let's just still go with that game. What are they pricing it on? First, they're looking at growth, but they're looking at growth and revenues, right? Because in a sense, there's no growth in income you can have when you're losing money. So high revenue growth companies should be trading at higher multiples of revenues than lower revenue growth companies. Okay. Second, whenever you're in a young sector, we know that most companies don't make it. So presumably, if I could come up with a proxy that measures the likelihood that you will not make it, companies that are more likely to make it should have higher revenue multiples than companies that are viewed as less likely to make it. And finally, paying 100 times revenues is not a big deal when you have $1 million in revenues, but as the revenues go to 100 million, 1 billion, you'd expect the multiple to shrink, right? So three variables. I'd expect larger revenue companies to have lower multiples than smaller revenue companies. I'd expect higher revenue growth companies to have higher multiples than lower revenue. See what I'm trying to do? I'm trying to come up with variables that might explain the pricing. So I ran the regression across just the dot-com companies. And first, the R-squared was 32%. Am I disappointed in this sector? I am delirious with joy that I'm getting an R-squared that's in the double digits, not the single digits. I can live with it. The coefficients all have the right signs. The revenue doesn't seem to really make a big difference, which surprised me, but partly at that time, there were only three or four of these companies that actually had substantial revenue, so maybe that's it. But high revenue growth companies have higher price-to-sales ratios, and for survival, I use cash as a percent of revenue. So why are you doing that? When you think about companies failing, if you're a mature company, you fail because you can't make a debt payment. If you're a young startup, you know how you fail? You run out of cash. When you run out of cash, you got to go back to the market, and if you're not able to raise it, the game is over. In fact, analyst tracking dot-com stocks, and many young companies still use what's called a cash burn ratio. What the cash burn ratio is the cash balance divided by the EBITDA. But the EBITDA is, remember, a negative number. Basically, the question they're asking is, how many months of cash do you have? And the more cash you have, the lower the chance of failure. So I'm using a very simplistic measure of survival by looking at how much. So the higher the cash, the greater the chance you will survive, and the higher the price to sales ratio. And that seemed to work out as well. Remember, I was doing this with Amazon in mind. I plugged in the numbers for Amazon, its revenues, its growth, which was 199.46% in revenues the previous year, and its cash balance, which was 31% of revenues. I got a predicted price-to-sales ratio for Amazon of 30.42. Given Amazon's characteristics, I'd expect to trade at 30.4 times revenues. It was actually trading at 25.6 times revenues. Think about it. Exactly the same time, on an intrinsic value basis, I'm telling you that Amazon is expensive. Don't buy it. On a relative valuation basis, what am I saying? Hey, it's a cheap company. It might sound like something you can never reconcile, but I'm telling you two different things, right? On the intrinsic valuation, based on the cash flows and the growth, it looks like it's too expensive. Here, what am I saying? Given how other dot-com stocks are being priced, this stock is your best bargain. And if I were an equity research analyst tracking dot-com stocks, guess what? My job is to do the latter, not the former. My job is not to tell you don't buy any dot-com stocks, because that's not my job. My job is I've been put in a sector. I have to tell you what the cheap stocks in that sector are, what the expensive ones. So remember that the next time you pick up an equity research report on a social media company, and the analyst says, buy Facebook, buy Twitter, buy Yelp, before you jump down the analyst's throat saying you're being too optimistic, He is making a different judgment than you might be making. His judgment is, hey, I have 15 social media companies in my sector. I have to tell you which one looks cheapest, and this is what I think. And he can do that. That's his job. And you can then decide whether it's something you want to incorporate into your portfolio. And you might not have to, because you don't have to own a social media stock in your portfolio. But you know who might? Lots of portfolio managers have sector constraints, which means their portfolios have to track market sector constraints in a very broad sense. So they might, the constraints are sometimes tight for, you know, it might be that if technology is 20% of the market, you're required to stay within 2 or 3% of that in your portfolio. Which essentially also means that you are, again, pushed into relative valuation, whether you like it or not, because of the constraints that get put on you. Here's the other solution. Yeah, go ahead, Dipinder.
So is it possible that, like, in the case of tech stocks at this time period, that the relationship will also, like, run the other way, where you have high price to sales, like in the example that we just talked about,
right?
High price to sales multiples would mean that a company could afford to, because it has access to, like, finance, it could afford to, like, spend a lot of money now, so its margins would be lower. You see what I'm saying? Like, instead of those factors, like, predicting the price.
Yeah, but you know what? Companies don't, once you go public, companies are very reluctant to raise capital, to spend all right away. So it's entirely possible. It could be that you're raising capital to do acquisitions. That's more likely than actually doing internal investments, which allows them to grow faster. So there might be a feedback effect. High price to sales ratios actually allows you to grow faster, and because of that, you know, so the cycle can actually push you up. But that same cycle can then spiral down, because whatever worked in your favor is going to start to work against you. So you can, but again, the one thing I would say is don't call them tech stocks, right? Call them young tech stocks or social media companies, because techs become too big and too diverse for us to group them together. But with young companies, what I'm saying is don't focus on last year's numbers too much, return equity, et cetera, because that's not where you're pricing these companies. You're pricing them based on expectations for the future. Yes, Nick?
Given that, would you ever adjust your options when you're doing a relative valuation, if you think the price isn't reflecting them in some way?
I think you have to walk a very fine line. With pricing, what are you saying? I'm going to reflect whatever the market's doing, right? You've entered into that game.
Yeah.
And if the market's being crazy, you've got to be a little crazy with the market as well, right? And if it makes you uncomfortable, you know what it's telling you. Don't play the pricing game. So I've, you know, fulminated against the use of adjusted EBITDA and not adding. But you know what? If you're in the pricing game, I can see exactly why you do what you do. If everybody else is adding back stock-based compensation and pricing stocks based on that, and you're playing that game, you got to do what, in a sense, everybody else is doing, not what is right. And that's why when I did intrinsic valuation, when people said, what if the market's not coming along to me? I said, I'm doing intrinsic valuation. I'm going to do my valuation based on what I think is fair and reasonable, you know, given my end game. When we get to pricing, you can play the game the way it's meant to be, but remember that they're two different games. What gets us into trouble is if I let that seep into my intrinsic valuation, if I let the pricing game seep in and start to use adjusted EBITDA when I do my DCF valuation. Or conversely, I start to become too, you know, intrinsic value based in my pricing, because again, I'm playing the wrong game for it. Okay? Now, here's the other way you can deal with young companies and you're doing multiples. You know, the biggest problem you face with all these companies is there's nothing there. You look at the last financials, there are no assets, there's no revenues, no income, and that's why none of the multiples are working. So if I ask you, what's the multiple for Snapchat right now? Taking last year's numbers, it's going to give me absurd numbers. So one way you can create some substance here is to go forward. So this is a technique that a lot of analysts use in sectors, is rather than dividing the market value by earnings last year, they will divide the market value today by expected earnings 5 years out. Rather than dividing the market value by revenues last year, they will divide by revenues 5 years out. Again, I don't have a problem with this. As long as you realize that if you use a forward multiple and a forward revenue, you get a forward value. But you're paying the price today. And there's many a slip between the cup and the lip. Getting from that forward value to what the value is today is non-intuitive. For instance, if I told you that a company's value is $68.3 billion 10 years from now, and ask you, how much would you pay for that company today? And I let you play, let your intuition play out. You'd say, even with compounding or a higher required rate of return, I'd pay 35, 30, 25. So I'm actually going to take an example of how easily value starts to slip away with young growth companies as you go from the value in the future to value today. And I'm going to use Tesla as my example to do this, because this was from my original valuation of Tesla way back when I got a value like $70 per share. Okay? And you can contest my assumptions, but one of the things that puzzled people in my valuation then was my terminal value was close to $70 billion. But the value that I was coming up with the equity today was $8 billion. So when they first looked at the valuation, they said, how are you losing $61.5 billion getting from that end value to today? So what I did was I actually took it and broke it down into pieces as to where the value was, all the leakages. So here's the first step. As I said, if I just discount back at the risk-free rate, $68 billion becomes $52 billion. So think of that as the risk-free cut taken away. That's pure time value of money. If I adjust for the fact that there's additional risk, that this is not a risk-free investment, I lose another $24 billion. So I go from 52 down to 27.75. That's still a pretty high number, right? But that is the value of the terminal value. And for the next 10 years, what am I doing, though? I am growing the company, reinvesting big amounts, and have big negative cash flows. If I factor in how much I will have to raise as new capital, you know where it shows up as negative cash flows for the first 7 years, my 27.7 billion becomes 12.8 billion. That is the value of the negative cash flows. If I adjust for the fact that there's a lot of stuff that can go wrong between now and then, there's a 10% chance I will not make it. I lose a little bit more value. Debt and cash don't make much of a difference. But because I've also granted a lot of these options, I lose another 4 billion. All I'm saying is if you use forward pricing, which is what you do, and I said don't do this in a DCF valuation, but if you use forward pricing and you come up with a number for your company, be very careful about how you use that number, because that number can look large, but it's 5 years out or 10 years out, and there's lots of stuff that has to happen in the next 5 or 10 years before you get to that number that will drain a lot of that value. So if you see forward valuations, forward pricing, forward EBITDA multiples, forward revenue multiples, exit multiples in IPO valuations. That's all they are, right? Forward pricing. It's not easily brought down to today by just discounting. There's other stuff that you have to take into account as well. Okay. Yes?
What is the 10% failure?
Well, remember, in a traditional DCF, remember distress companies, we attach the probability of failure, and what happens with Tesla, given the fact that they're losing money and that they have a lot of things to get through, I assume there's a 90% chance of a going concern for the DCF valuation, a 10% chance it will not make it, and a book value which gave me a much lower value for equity. So it's knocking off, not a huge amount, but that's what the 10% does to me. Yes?
How did you project out the dilution by the equity issue?
Just take the free cash flow of the firm. Right? So when I did my DCF valuation, you take the present value of the free cash flows to the firm for the next 10 years, and you get a big negative number. That's a dilution effect right there. So rather than count it as number of shares, I'm counting it as a present value of the free cash flow for the next 10 years. So it's actually, when you do a DCF, it's amazing how much you can learn by starting to split it apart, right? Because right now it's all collection of numbers. You get the present value today, and then you leave the rest of the valuation. Start to kind of look at how do I get from that end number to now? What's happening in the middle? Because that will give you some very interesting insights into young growth companies and what will cause that value to change. So actually, right after I did this, of course, there are a lot of Tesla bulls who took issues, I don't know, it's worth a lot more. And I said, here's the key. What's the biggest loss of value you're coming from? It's coming from that dilution, right? Which comes from reinvestment in the next 10 years. So I said, if you have a Tesla story to tell me, here's the story I need to hear to become a bull. If you can show me that Fremont plant that they have a big plant in Fremont that they, is big enough to cover all their growth needs for the next 10 years. That's going to make the value of the company almost $15 billion higher, which is going to triple my value. So it's going to go from 70 to 210. So I said, so that's the point I make when I value these young growth companies. It's not because I want to convince people to sell short. In fact, about half the comments after I did this valuation is, who are you working for? What short seller paid you to do this? And I said, no, you think I'm that cheap? Right? My point is, we need to open a conversation about these companies that's about real things. So if I ask you, why are you buying Tesla? I don't want you to tell me that you love your Tesla, whatever, that's the greatest car in the face of the earth. I want you to tell me something substantial about reinvestment. So if you have a story about the free market, I'd love to hear that. Because that's a story that is about value, about the capacity of the plant. Because that ultimately is what drives the value of a company, those big decisions you make. So that's relative valuation. Now let's talk about expanding our sample. All our analyses so far, we've looked at sectors, right? And nice, it's nice to stay with 25, 30, 35 companies. But if you're doing pricing, why price everything just against the sector? Why not price everything against the entire market? What do you gain by doing it? Much larger sample size, right? What do you lose by doing it? A lot more stuff to control for. But one of the nice things is if you have a big sample size in your regression, you can have 5, 7, 8 variables and it'll still work. So every year, here's what I do. I take every multiple and I run a market regression. I run it against US stocks, emerging market stocks, global stocks. Basically, I run every combination. You think against what? I keep it restricted. These are not kitchen sink regressions. You know what kitchen sink regressions are? You basically, your end game is to get the highest R squared you can. So you try this, you try that. No, how fat is the CEO? Let's throw that in there. It makes the R squared go up. Let's leave that in there. It's fine. If your exercise is statistical and you want to pump up the R squared, that's exactly what you should do. That's not my end game. So I want to explain PE using what? Growth, payout, and risk. I want to get price to book, growth, payout, risk, and return equity. So that's why the sequencing mattered. I have the variables already. So I start with PE ratio. Everybody uses it. Might as well see it. And if you think about the companion variable for PE, whenever people talk about PE, they talk about growth, right? So before I ran the regression, here's the first thing I did. I ran a scatter plot of price-earnings ratios against growth rates for all U.S. companies. And I knew I was in big trouble. See why? If this is the dominant variable explaining growth, first, it's not a particularly strong. I mean, look at that big chunk in the middle. The direction of the relationship, the line fits okay. It's a positive, but there's a lot of noise, which kind of prepares me that when I run this regression of price earnings against growth rates, I shouldn't expect to see R squareds of 85-90%. There's enough noise here that that's not going to happen. But I ran the regression anyway. 35.5% R squared, not bad. Here are the coefficients. Remember what I promised you. I'd keep it restricted to what I thought mattered. The beta, because that shows up in the cost of equity, the payout ratio, and the expected growth rate in earnings per share. So let's look at the output. The 6.48, that is your base from which you're going to build up every company. Every 1% increase of 1 in my beta reduces my PE by 3.25. That makes sense to you? Higher risk companies, lower PE, that makes sense. Higher payout ratios increase my PE by 0.17. Again, it makes sense. Higher payout ratio for any given growth rate is a good thing, pushes up my PE. And higher growth rate increases my PE by 0.99. Every 1% increase in your growth rate increases your PE by 0.99. The T statistics are all significant. Notice that the T statistic in growth is by far the highest, which is usually the case with the companion variable. It's a variable that still best explains difference in growth. But it's across the entire market. Now, I have to tell you that I've run this regression 23 years. I think in 12 of the years, beta has had the right sign. You know what I mean by the right sign? It's got a negative coefficient. In 11 of the years, the beta has had the wrong sign. Wrong sign in what sense? High beta companies have high PE ratios. And that freaks people out. When you run the regression for your stocks, you're going to see a coefficient sometimes in a variable that you're saying, but high-risk companies should have lower PEs, not higher. You can't mess with the regression output. So please don't take the minus and draw another line through. So that looks much better now. It's a plus. Okay? There's a reason why it happens. And it goes back to what we talked about when we talked about what you need to run a good regression. We talked about independent variables being uncorrelated with each other, right? And the variables I'm using are what? Growth, beta, and payout. Think about it. If you have a high growth company, what do you expect to see as a beta? Low beta or a high beta if you look across the market? Probably a high beta. And a high payout or a low payout? Your low payout. So in a sense, what you often find are high beta companies. So the first problem you have with this regression is the independent variables are not independent of each other. They're correlated. There's multicollinearity. The second is this is a linear regression. And remember we talked about in the context of PEG ratios, maybe there's a non-linearity here. And third, it's a regression as of January 1st, 2015. Saying, so what? It's a very unstable regression. You run these regressions over time, the coefficients will change depending on when you run the regression. All things to file away. But I focused in on the correlation, and here's the simplest way to see the problem. I took my three independent variables and the PE, and I threw them into this called a correlation matrix. If this is a good multiple regression, you know what you should see as your correlation coefficients across the independent variables? They should all be zero except for the diagonal. So you should see one across the diagonal, zeros everywhere else. But that's not what you see. You see, for instance, that high beta companies tend to have low payout ratios. That high beta companies tend to have high growth rates. You're saying, what are those things? That means you have statistically significant correlation across the variables. We have multicollinearity. Before you freak out, though, I'll give you some good news on multicollinearity. Multicollinearity makes the coefficients in individual variables tough to read. So when you see a beta have a positive coefficient, you know what it's telling you, right? Since beta and growth tend to move together, the computer gets really confused about what beta is measuring. And after a while, it says, I think beta measures growth rather than risk. It makes it confusing. But the overall regression can still be used. So if you don't read individually into the coefficients, you can still use the overall regression to come up with predicted PE ratios for companies. And actually, there's a use for it, right? So take that regression, for instance. And let's suppose I came to you with a company, okay? Disney. I gave you its beta, its growth rate, and its payout ratio. And I said, can you tell me whether Disney's cheap or expensive? Notice, I'm not giving you time to run a discounted cash flow evaluation. You might not even have time to run a sector regression. You have one regression equation for the market and the numbers for Disney. You know what you can do? Plug in 1.25 for the beta, growth rate of 0.15, and payout ratio of 0.2. I don't remember what I got, but I think I got a predicted PE for Disney. I don't know whether I updated it, but somewhere in the bottom this should be. I got a predicted PE for Disney of 20.10. See what I mean by predicted? I'm just plugging in the numbers for Disney into that regression. It's actually trading at 20 times earnings. So based on how the market is pricing everything else, Disney should be priced at 20 times earnings. It's actually trading at 20. It's very slightly. In fact, that's a good point you raised, because when you run regression, if you have a regression package, when you get a predicted number, it'll actually give you a range around it. In the case of Disney, that range was about 1.2 in each direction. It says the PE for Disney is anywhere from 18.9 to... So you're within the range. But if you do this for every U.S. stock, there will be stocks that fall outside the range in either direction. You could be a one-person hedge fund with a regression equation as your only tool. And here's what you'll do. You'll buy the 100 cheapest stocks relative to the predicted numbers and sell short the 100 most expensive, then get down on your knees and hope and pray what happens? That they move towards the regression line. That's the unknown. But that's pricing carried to its logical limit. You're going to be pricing, might as well price with all the information and hope that you get convergence. And odds are that convergence is going to happen quicker than something based on intrinsic valuation, because it is actually a convergence that is a pricing-based convergence, and you're hoping for convergence towards the line. So that's part of the reason I run these regressions. And here's another little piece of another side benefit you get. The coefficient that I got on growth was point, if you go back a couple of pages, 98.579. If I convert into a decimal, I get 0.99. So right now, for every 1% increase in growth, the market is paying 0.99, but giving you a higher PE. If you remember, the equity risk premium is what the market is charging for risk. So every year I've been tracking these numbers, because it's giving me a measure of how much the market is pricing growth at and how much it's pricing risk at. If you're a high growth, high risk company, What's nirvana for you? A really high price for growth and a really low price for risk, right? If the market is pricing growth as a really good thing and not punishing risk very much, you're going to be this incredibly high multiple. Take a look at January 2000. Every 1% increase in growth increases my PE by 2.10. My equity risk premium is tiny. That's the peak of the dot-com boom. You're a high-growth, high-risk company. You're going to be trading at 150 times earnings. 2 years later, after the correction, the price of growth has dropped by half. The price of risk has almost doubled. I use very few macro variables to track the market. This is one of the few that I track. Because let's suppose I told you there's a bubble in the market, growth companies are being overpriced. What am I saying? That this number has become too high, right? That markets are paying too... I don't see that in the data right now. It could be different a year from now. I don't see high growth companies as being massively overpriced. It's a pure pricing judgment. But it's something that might help you kind of decide whether something is cheap or expensive. Let me do one final thing before we end them. I decided to do the same thing for PEG ratios. And if you remember, PEG ratios is growth, payout, and risk as well. So I took PEG ratios and did this. And I know this is reaching, but that doesn't look linear to me. It's all these little points. I'll give you the trick I use, and a statistics professor would shoot me for suggesting this. Whenever I run into serious nonlinearities, here's what I do. I take the natural log of the variable that's causing the nonlinearities. You know, the natural log is the small ln, not the log base 10. There are all these logs that they put on the calculator just to confuse you. Just get rid of all the other log buttons, the natural log button. So here's what I did. I took the PEG ratio and I did log of growth rather than growth. And the lines, I mean, still have a lot of noise, but you can see I have a better shot of fitting a linear regression. So when I ran my regression, so that's something, again, you might want to think about. When you pick a dependent variable, before you run into the regression and start running the regression, do a scatter plot of each to see if there's serious nonlinearity. And if there is, just take the natural log of that variable. It's amazing how often that makes a nonlinear relationship linear. And finally, here's the regression I ran for the PEG ratio. So this is just like the PE ratio regression, same three variables, but the difference is instead of using the actual growth rate, I use the log of the growth rate as my dependent variable. R squared of 48%, so we're getting better. All the variables have the signs I'd expect them to. And again, if you gave me Disney as a company, I could plug it into this PEG ratio regression and do this. One final thing, if you look at the intercept, it's a negative number. And that's a little troublesome, because when you have a negative intercept and you use it at PE ratios, you can end up with a negative PE for a company, which might not bother you, but it does bother me. So here's a quick trick you can try. If you have a regression, the intercept is negative. Most regression packages actually let you run the regression through the origin. Basically, it sets the intercept to zero. It'll be a little option in there. It's not great statistically to do this because it's not the best fit line anymore because you've tilted the line to make it go through the origin. But if you do that, you no longer have this problem of negative PEs and negative PEG ratios. So this is the PEG ratio regression with the intercept set to zero. And again, the end game here is if you gave me a company like Disney, I could plug the numbers into this regression and give you a predicted PEG ratio for Disney, which I think I've done in the next page. And again, that's why we run these market regressions, is it allows us to use this big regression to get predicted prices. So when you get a chance, plug the numbers for your company into this market regression and see what you get. So I'll see you on Wednesday. One of the group of three that you sent me?
I don't remember getting a group of kids, so maybe I answered that question.
I think we have to start with.